You guys know I'm crazy about Audible because it offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Audible really is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment, with female writers and heroines, celebrity narration, multicast productions with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks. Audible has you covered for any type of excitement that you're looking for. In fact, right now I'm listening to The Second Husband by Kate White. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. That's audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. With four daughters and two on a dance team, I can tell you we go through a lot of mascara in my house. But I'm crazy about L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, which catches every lash from corner to corner for maximum volume. If you're looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank, this is yours. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. I've been using it for about 2 weeks now, and I feel like my eye has completely opened up, and the girls are crazy about it too. They've got a tapered brush to catch every lash, one of the best mascara wands that I've ever used. And like I said, this luxe appearance of this gold package, you got to get it. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara. You're going to love it.
The amazing Kate Casey.
Welcome back to another episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey. Hope that you've had a great week. And I am still fired up about Sister Wives. And judging from social media, I know a lot of you are as well. I asked Steve to give his input yet again this month about what he thinks about this season, particularly Sunday's episode, and you will hear that later. Have to say, one of the highlights of the episode was watching Janelle walk away from Cody and tell him to F off, something he certainly deserved. She found herself in a war of words with Cody over his COVID-19 concerns. Now, he has asked the family to adhere to a list of strict guidelines for COVID. The surprising thing is, they're the same guidelines that you really saw the first week of the pandemic when people like my husband were Cloroxing bananas and doing a full wipe down on mail and keeping packages outside for a week. And you ask yourself, you're like, why is he still being so strict about it? And I have to believe that it has to do with production. He must be so paranoid about production delays and how the whole family can operate and how that train can keep moving. That must be part of it. But I do also think that he likes Robin more than the other wives. And it's funny because in this episode, Janelle has said, listen, I kind of like my independence. And my idea of a plural marriage was maybe I see it like once or twice a week, enough that I have the rest of the week to read whatever book I want to at night and not have to talk to you. Christine, who's always wanted more of a relationship with Cody, says that every time he comes over, which is almost never, he barely talks to the kids. He's on his phone the whole time, and he's up early in the morning before they get up, and he's gone back to Robin's house. Now, Robin's around this guy all the time, and she's like, guys, my idea of plural marriage was what Janelle wanted, which is, again, I get to watch my own shows all week, and this guy leaves me alone. But now, because I'm the most subservient one, he's at the house all day long. And not only that, these two are together all the time in that house, but they've also hired a nanny and the nanny's husband, who does all the grocery shopping for them, to take care of the two kids at home because the other kids are too old and they don't need a babysitter. None of it makes sense. So it's almost like a Dateline meets a cult documentary all in one season, which is kind of amazing. So Cody says to them, all the wives, as they sat down to discuss Thanksgiving and Christmas plans, he's like, you'd have to go through these guidelines if we can all be together. And by the way, these people, they haven't even spent that much time together in the 9 months prior to this holiday fiesta season. I mean, they barely know each other anymore. So Cody says, no guilt trip, just a little prick to your conscience. You guys decide what you want to do. So Janelle ultimately decides to spend Thanksgiving away from the family after disagreeing with Cody about their adult sons, Garrison and Gabriel, maintaining their social lives during the pandemic. Because one of them is a girlfriend. He's like, listen, I'm not going to be Cloroxing my bananas. I want to go out and see my girlfriend. And if you have a problem with that, then I can talk to dad on camera. And I was like, can we make that happen? Because a lot of the show is really quite boring. I don't want to see them like making butterscotch in the kitchen. I want to see Cody talk to his adult sons who are far more educated than him, who have zero interest in polygamy and have really strong, powerful voices. That's what this show is made for. And I have to say, it's been kind of boring the last couple seasons, and now it's kind of setting the night on fire. So, and by the way, I think I mentioned this before, someone in my Facebook group posted a picture of Cody and Robin at the mall in Arizona with no masks on, and they let someone take their picture. So I'm like, I don't understand the discrepancy, who you are on this TV show and who you are when you need to go out and get a new pair of capri pants. So, again, Janelle, she spends it with the kids on Thanksgiving. Christine's like, listen, if it comes between you, Cody, and my kids will always win. And for that, I did a hand salute to her because I'm like, these women, they're great moms. So he says, I'm not going to tell this family how to do it. I'm going to lead the way that I think is the right way, adding that the other women had an obligation to a very large amount of people to keep the family running smoothly. Again, I think this has to do about making the money from production, et cetera. Nonetheless, you got to start watching. In this episode, I also talked to Ryan Ferguson from Dream Killer on Netflix. If you love true crime, I'm telling you, you've got to watch it. So in 2005, 20-year-old Ryan Ferguson was convicted and sentenced to 40 years in prison for a crime that he did not commit, causing his father, Bill, to embark on a 10-year campaign to prove Ryan's innocence. Bill Ferguson, an army man born and raised in Missouri, had never been one to back away from a challenge, traveling across the world, pretending to be a welder, teaching at an Aboriginal school in Australia, and spending an inordinate amount of time with his two kids, Kelly and Ryan. But after Ryan was charged and convicted for a murder based on someone else's dream, Bill took on the challenge that he had never could have anticipated, the American judicial system. So after Ryan's conviction, Bill began walking over the crime scene and researching the trial. He uncovered witness coercion and intimidation by the prosecution, wide-ranging evidence omissions, and deeply flawed interrogation tactics. And with the help of Kathleen Zellner, a prominent wrongful conviction lawyer, Ryan's family and his legal team went to battle. I want to say thank you to Christine DeSanctis, who saw that I wanted to interview Ryan and helped connect us. This is by far one of my favorite interviews that I've ever done.
Okay, thoughts on Sister Wives and more specifically the demise of Cody Brown. Last episode, we started to see signs of this happening. Tension between the various wives and Cody and the overly strict COVID rules that he's using as an excuse to not see his family members, and more specifically, the older children. And it really kind of came to a head in this episode. I think I'm rejoining Sister Wives at the right time. Last episode, he had alienated half of his wives, and I think he added Janelle to the mix this episode. So now, 3/4 of his wives can't stand him, and Robin's patience is wearing very thin because she has made it clear that she's really not interested in having a monogamous relationship with Cody because he gets on her nerves after a while and apparently has been moody as well. So, you know, time will tell how much longer she can hold out dealing with him and his insanity. I had thought maybe last episode that Robin was perhaps the puppet master behind the scenes, kind of pulling the strings and secretly enjoying having Cody all to herself. But she made it pretty clear, I think genuinely, to Janelle in this episode that she, in fact, is not happy with this arrangement. But as Cody said several times in the episode, she's the compliant wife. So he is obviously gravitated to her because, unlike the other ones who have enjoyed more independence in their relationship with him and have older independent children who can think for themselves, Robin's a little more stuck. And because of that, she's now truly stuck with Cody in her house 24/7, which must be just an absolute prison. I thought maybe she could step up a little more and provide some pressure on him to the benefit of the other wives to tell him his rules are a little ludicrous. I mean, the idea of sanitizing your mail and leaving it outside for 24 hours before you open it is absolutely ridiculous. I'll grant anyone during this COVID era the right to do what they think is appropriate to keep themselves safe and healthy. But we learned last night that we're basically 9 months into the pandemic at the time of taping. So at that point, life had returned to normal for the majority of the country. I know personally, after the first couple of weeks, we had really loosened up on our protocols and had gotten back to, you know, normal living. So to still be that over the top about concern about contracting COVID 9 months into the pandemic, it leads me to believe there's ulterior motives there. Primarily, he made the mention about the economic impact to the family of them getting sick. And I think that probably has to do entirely with taping. And if he is not taping, he's probably not getting paid. And that is obviously the primary source of income for their family. So I think all of this is entirely a concern about money, which is sad for one, but also shows where his priorities are around his family, because he has clearly put that well ahead of the interests of his wives and his children. The tension was obvious between his older children, Janelle's kids, and you know Gabriel, Garrison, and Savannah, and Cody. The fact that they hadn't seen their dad really in 9 months, aside from the occasional front yard visit where he's raking leaves, and no one really wants him around. So there's real tension and a family that's completely broken down here. Entirely due to his selfishness and stubbornness. We've seen this play out year over year with Cody, where he's clearly a very stubborn person. And even when he's clearly wrong, he digs his heels in. And I think this is another one of those instances where he's digging his heels in at the detriment of his family. And it's sad. I mentioned this in the last podcast that I think the wives and the kids are really solid units together, and they've done well to have I think mature adult children, and the one child in the room continues to be Cody, and I think the wives have finally woken up to that and realized that this guy is nothing more than a clown who's probably stolen the best 20 years of their lives and taken them on a crazy journey that they didn't really sign up for or should have gone along with. And now they're, stuck in this undeveloped property with a huge amount to be done to get it to their ultimate vision. And three of them are pretty checked out at this point. So, in Cody's eyes, the grand savior for the whole family was to develop this piece of property, get everyone their own home, and then everything will be all right. But the whole family unit is clearly eroding from within, and it's all his fault. So I will probably stay tuned because this is developing a very different way than I had envisioned, and it's a slow motion train wreck. So let's see what happens. And if history is any indicator, Cody will continue to be the stubborn child that he is and make things worse. Those are my thoughts.
Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way that you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, and they pass the savings on to us. So I just got a 100% organic cotton tiered maxi skirt in red and a chiffon pleated midi skirt in soft pink. Now I'm going to wear both of them with either a white scoop t-shirt or a black tank top. In fact, wait, should we all get the same outfit and meet for drinks? Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/KateCasey for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/KateCasey to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/KateCasey. This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. If you're looking for new style inspiration, Saks.com is the place to go. Saks.com is making it easy for me to shop for the spring with their selection of chic clothes and accessories. Right now, I'm looking at Saks.com so I can find my new going out vibe. I'm looking for a breezy Zimmermann dress for an evening cocktail party. And for my upcoming conference in Los Angeles, I'm looking at bright Chloe blazers because I'm pushing myself to wear more orange and pink. Saks.com will inspire you to shop for everything on your agenda. So find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com. I first became aware of Ryan Ferguson's case in an episode of 48 Hours Mystery years ago. That case was later the subject of a Netflix documentary called Dream Killer. Ryan spent nearly 10 years in prison after being wrongfully convicted of a 2001 murder in his hometown of Columbia, Missouri. At the time of the murder, he was a 17-year-old high school student. Ken Heithold was found beaten and strangled shortly after 2 a.m. on November 1st, 2001, in the parking lot of the Columbia Daily Tribune, where he worked as a sports editor. Kent was known for being incredibly kind and a champion for the underdog. His murder went unsolved for 2 years until police received a tip about a man named Charles Erickson, who had spent that evening partying with Ryan. Erickson could not remember the evening of the murder and was concerned that he may have been involved in it. Despite failing to recall having killed Ken Heithold, Erickson eventually confessed and implicated Ryan in the crime as well. Ryan was convicted in the fall of 2005 on the basis of his testimony as well as that of a building employee. Both witnesses later recanted their testimony, claiming that the police and prosecuting attorney, Kevin Crane, who's now a circuit court judge, had coerced them to lie. The 2005 conviction was vacated on November 5th, 2013 by the Western District of the Missouri Court of Appeals, and Ryan Ferguson was released on the evening of November 12th after spending nearly a decade in prison. He won $11 million in a civil suit against Missouri police. Kent was last seen alive by coworker Michael Boyd, who told police that he had a work-related conversation with him in the parking lot between 2:12 and 2:20. Minutes later, janitor Shauna Ornt stepped outside for a cigarette break and saw two shadowy figures near his car. She ran back inside to get her supervisor, Jerry Trump. Both janitors witnessed two college-age men near his car, and the janitors reported that one of the men yelled, "Someone's out here hurt, man," before both men walked away through a nearby alley. The janitors notified other employees and called 911 at 2:26. Heithold was found severely beaten and with a blunt object and strangled. On that same evening, Ryan and his classmate Charles Erickson were attending Halloween parties in the area. They later proceeded to meet Ryan's sister at a bar called By George because a bouncer who worked there would admit them despite their age. After the two men had spent all of their money at the bar, Ryan's sister bought them a few additional drinks before they departed. Charles Erickson was under the influence of cocaine, Adderall, and alcohol that night, and the following day, he had no memory of what had happened. At a later hearing, attorneys asked Erickson whether he had noticed anything unusual on the morning of November 1st, such as injuries or blood on his clothing, but he stated that he had not noticed anything out of the ordinary. Police recovered unidentified fingerprints on and inside Ken Heithold's car, as well as an unidentified hair in his hand. Police also recovered footprints from the blood at the crime of the scene. Ornt provided police with a description of the men and a composite sketch was drawn. The crime had been unsolved for 2 years when, in October 2003, local media again covered the murder. Erickson had reportedly experienced several dreams about the crime after having seen a newspaper article. And a few days later, Erickson asked Ryan Ferguson whether he believed that Erickson may have been involved in the murder. "It was crazy that someone had been murdered a couple blocks away from where we had been partying," replied Erickson. Ryan reassured him that he was not involved in the crime. Erickson said that over time, he began to increasingly ponder the murder and the fact that he could not remember that evening. In November of 2003, Erickson read an article in the local newspaper that included a sketch of a possible suspect. He thought that the sketch resembled him and became more concerned, and he told friends, Nick Gilpin and Art Figueroa, about his worries, and they notified police. In the recorded interrogation, Erickson seems to have little knowledge of the crime. He told police, "It's just so foggy, I could be sitting here fabricating all of it." And at one point, he was asked questions about the weapon used to strangle Ken Heitholt. Erickson replied that he thought it was a shirt. And when the police officer told him that it was not, he replied, "Maybe a bungee cord." Eventually, the officer told Erickson that the weapon was Heitholt's own belt. And Erickson replied, "I don't remember that at all." After much prodding by investigators, Erickson eventually told them that he and Ryan robbed Heitholt for drinking money. In March of 2004, Erickson and Ryan were arrested and charged with murder. In this episode, I got a chance to talk to Ryan about his wrongful conviction, and I'm glad to say that he has been doing so well since being released, and I was thrilled to see that he was cast this season of The Amazing Race. I am really excited for you to hear my interview with Ryan Ferguson. Now, Ryan and his friend Dusty Harris are competing this season on The Amazing Race on CBS, an outstanding show. It's an adventure reality game show franchise in which teams of two people race around the world in competition with other teams. This series began filming in February of 2020, but had to take an 18-month hiatus due to the COVID-19 pandemic. I was so excited to see that he would be part of the cast. And so I got a chance to talk to him about his documentary, being on 48 Hours Mystery, his life experience, and of course, being on The Amazing Race. Ryan Ferguson, I first saw your story on 48 Hours Mystery. Then I saw the documentary. I'm very familiar with your case. Followed it for many years. Was thrilled when you were released. And I'm so happy to see you today. And I feel like we're newfound friends. How are you?
I am wonderful. Thanks for having me on, Kate. I feel like we're definitely newfound friends. I'm just so happy we had the opportunity to meet. And this is going to be incredible.
So your story is unbelievable. Take me back to the day that you were arrested.
Wow. You get right into it.
I know.
Yeah. it was tough, obviously. But you know, it was a normal day for me. I was in college. I was going to school. I was on my way back. And then I was swarmed by police. And I mean, it was terrifying. I didn't know who was pulling up on me or why they were rushing me. I didn't understand what was happening. And they're yelling at me. And then they tell me I'm under arrest. And I'm like, what possibly could I have done? And I had midterms the next day. So that was my biggest concern, as they're taking me in to be questioned for, they wouldn't tell me what. And when they finally said, okay, we're questioning for this murder that happened years ago, I'm like, oh, okay, well, no big deal. Obviously, I have nothing to do with that. I'll answer your questions. I'll go home and study and, you know, continue with my life and take my midterms. Not until 10 years later could I actually get out and study again. And I did actually take midterms again, but it was much, much later.
So a year and a half after this arrest, you're tried and convicted of second-degree murder and first-degree robbery on the basis of Chuck Erickson's testimony. He had pled guilty in exchange for his testimony and began serving a 25-year sentence. You were sent to prison for 40 years. What sustained you?
I would say 100% the number one thing that sustained me was family. If you followed my case, you could just see how much they were doing for me on a daily basis. And if you've seen the Dream Killer documentary, you see how my dad has just time after time after time been there for me, found evidence, continued to fight to prove my innocence and get my freedom. My mom also did that. She was behind the scenes. She doesn't get as much credit, but she deserves 100% equally as much credit. I have the most amazing parents. I'm so fortunate. And I, you know, number one, family. I could not have made it without them in so many ways. And the other thing that got me through is, especially in the beginning, was just ignorance. You know, I did not understand how our criminal justice system operated. I did not know that it wasn't about fact or fiction. It wasn't about right and wrong. It's about getting convictions. And police and prosecutors oftentimes there are some great ones. Definitely not putting down the whole profession. I respect that profession to a large degree, but there are also a lot of police and prosecutors who do not seek justice for the victims, for the people that they're going to arrest. Like, they don't seek justice for the community. And that's a terrifying thing. And I didn't realize that. So I really believed I'd be able to prove my innocence very easily, get out, continue with my life. And not until I realized that the real goal was just to get convictions, did I realize that I was going to be in there for the long haul.
And your father, who we will get into in a minute, is an amazing person. Your attorney was an expensive attorney. So there's this, you know, this conception that if you pay someone who is an expensive attorney, that you're absolutely going to get the best representation. That was not the case in your trial.
Absolutely right. That's a good point. Thanks for bringing that up. I did have a paid attorney, and a lot of people don't. They call them in the county jail public pretenders, the public defenders. And it's kind of an unfortunate name because a lot of public defenders do care. They're trying to do good work, but they're under-resourced and understaffed, and they can't help people that much because, you know, they're going up against the prosecution, who has limitless amounts of money and resources, and they take advantage of that. So I was fortunate enough to have paid defense. Unfortunately, my paid defense took our money and basically did nothing. Right. When I got convicted, and this is after my attorney got my name wrong in trial. He used maps and was pointing in the wrong directions. He got facts wrong. He did a terrible job. And instead of giving me a life sentence, I got 30 years with an additional 10 years. So it was 40 years, which is just as bad. And he had the audacity, my attorney, to come in to me the next day after I was convicted and given 40 years right after my 21st birthday and say, well, at least we didn't get a life sentence.
Oh, my God.
I'm like, you kidding me? You didn't even know my name in trial. Like, and this happens to people
all the time.
All the time.
And even the memory expert failed you as well. She was not prepared for trial. She fumbled.
Great point.
They're also, you know, it's not just the attorneys. Sometimes it's the other members of the team that fumbled through the trial as well.
You're absolutely correct. And what's interesting about that is it actually goes back to the attorney because, and I, you know, it's not solely the attorney. It's also the memory expert's responsibility to do a professional job. But our attorney did not prepare her. He did not speak to her before testifying. Actually, when she flew in, and most people don't know this, but when she flew in to come testify, the attorneys were supposed to be there to pick her up and to go over documents with her, review with her, prepare her. Nobody was there to pick her up. They didn't meet with her that night. They met with her for, I think, a few minutes in the morning, and that was about it. And that happened time after time. Our attorneys completely failed. And then they failed our expert witnesses, which we had to pay inordinate amounts of money for. Mm-hmm. And then the whole thing falls apart. So it begins and ends with the attorneys, but we definitely had some pretty poor representation all the way around.
This is when your father walks into the picture. He's brilliant because he walked media through the crime scene. He gave people tours of the crime scene just to show people how ridiculous this whole scenario is. How did he have the foresight to do that?
That's a great question. You know, I try to pull that out of him. He will say that, you know, he used to watch crime movies when he was young, you know, back in the theater in the 50s and 60s. And he would walk down into town and watch these movies while his father was at the pool hall. And that's really what gave him this interest to travel the world and really dig into things deeper and try to understand them. And it's just incredible what he's done with his life. You know, he went to the military. He made E5 in 2 years, or I think it was E6 in 2 years. And then he drove across Africa with my mother, and they lived in Australia for 8 years where I was born. I mean, the guy just keeps going mm-hmm. and keeps learning and keeps doing amazing things. And so he was kind of built for this. I'm so lucky that the roles weren't reversed. I guess he's lucky the roles weren't reversed because I wouldn't have been able to do anything for him, even if like it was my sole passion and sole desire. It was just incredible what he was able to think of and come up with and execute.
He was relentless. And it reminded me how important it is for, that all of us have an advocate, whether it's for your medical needs, it's for your legal needs too. And I thought of how many people don't have a legal advocate, someone that will work tirelessly for them and on their behalf. How much did his help impact this case?
I would say that without the help of my father, I would still be in prison today. It impacted the case that much. Without him, you know, the information, the facts of this case would never have gotten out. And a lot of the facts never would have even been revealed. I wouldn't even know about them because the police hid them from us. And my father was able to root that out and be able to show the world that these facts existed and that the world needed to see this and that the courts needed to see this. And because of that, you know, 48 hours happened, Dateline happened. We got the amazing attorney, Kathleen Zellner, who, I mean, she's just brilliant. But without the work of my father and the finding of these facts and the speaking to media to be able to get these facts out, because we knew that the justice system wasn't going to get these facts out. We had to go through media. Without that, we would have never had Kathleen. We would have never had somebody to file an appeal and prove my innocence.
Kathleen Zellner is a legend.
Legend, 100%.
How did she find you? Was it your father? Did your father give her a call? Like, how did she get involved?
Oh, great question. I was actually dating someone at the time, and I was in prison. Someone who started writing. She was a really amazing person, somebody I'm still very good friends with, and I have nothing but love and respect for. But she saw Kathleen on another case, and I think it was the E! Channel. And was like, I'm going to reach out to this attorney. So she did. And then I called her the next day. She's like, I reached out to this attorney. I hope you don't mind. I'm like, no, not at all. And Kathleen said, you know what? I had this case in the back of my mind. I wrote it down somewhere that if these people ever reach out to me, I'm going to take this case. And that's exactly what happened. So, you know, kind of a couple of weeks after that, we had the fortune of Erickson admitting that he lied. And so the ball started rolling from there. And even then, it took 4 years for me to get out.
That was the part that was most shocking. So that's 4 years after your conviction. He writes a letter to Kathleen. And she files a motion to get you a new trial based on new evidence. She made note of 17 inconsistencies between his deposition and trial testimony. How could they accept his testimony when he was so drunk and drugged? I can't get past that.
Yeah, I have a big problem with this. And I'm sure you've noticed this. When you watch cases like mine, and there's a lot of them, you featured a lot of them on your podcast, which I just want to say thank you so much for doing that. I know every exoneree appreciates that, or a person who is still convicted of a crime they didn't commit. But anyways, just much love for that. But the fact is, and you see this, watch, people who start watching these 48 hours Datelines, they'll start seeing it. Whenever a person testifies against a defendant, right, then the police, no matter how that person, they could be cracked out, drug addict, and have a list of felonies to the end of this world. But if they're testifying against you, and that's what the prosecution wants, they're reliable. But if a nice little grandmother who comes in with an apple pie and she's never done anything wrong and raised 15 kids, you know, excellent, and she's just the most amazing person in the world, she comes and says, that's not the person I saw. The prosecution is going to come in and say, that woman is lying. She has no credibility. She's worthless. It's insane. I've seen them do this to me. I've seen them do this to other people whose cases I've been watching and advocated for. And I've seen them do this to cases that I've never even met the people. It's terrifying how the prosecution will vilify good people to put innocent people in prison.
And also in this case, the interrogation techniques.
Oh boy. Yeah, interrogation techniques. In this case, especially, and so many, they're so bad. They take advantage of a youth. They take advantage of someone who was intoxicated, Erickson, and they know they lied. And they gave away evidence that was unique that Erickson never could have come up with because he was not there. Never would he have come up with that if they didn't tell him. But the good thing is, and I'm very fortunate for this, that this was videotaped. A lot of interrogations are not videotaped, so they can't prove what we were able to prove. And when they can't prove how this these investigators completely just screwed the case up and didn't care about getting real facts. They just, it was obvious because of the videos that they just wanted to get a conviction and that they were giving away information that was unique and no way would anybody but the person who committed that crime knew.
So you were released in 2013. Tell me about the moment that you found out that you were going to be released.
11/12/13 was the date.
Wow.
It's crazy, right? But the moment I was really, I love this one because that day was very chaotic. They overturned my conviction a week before. So when they do that, you don't get out immediately. It might take a month. You might not ever get out. So that was a nervous week. And then the morning they let me out, I didn't know I was getting out. The warden came in and said, "Hey, pack your stuff, come with me." And I'm like, "Oh man, they're going to put me in the hole." I thought they were locking me up in ADSEG. And, you know, I had my friend call my dad. I was like, "Dude, I don't know what they're doing to me." They're like, "Look, just pack your stuff. Let's go." So they did. And then they put me in handcuffs and shackles, walked me to the front. They were going to release me from there. The paperwork got messed up. The warden actually came back and said, "Hey man, I am sorry." I was in street clothes for the first time in 10 years. The warden comes back, says, "I am so sorry, Ryan. You got to put back on your prison clothes. We got to reshackle you. We got to rehandcuff you. We got to put you in a van and we got to send you to Columbia." So they do. The people driving me to Columbia still don't know if I'm getting out. They get lost. They asked me for directions and the directions actually changed. The roads changed. So we got lost. I got lost with them and it was a whole adventure. I end up pulling into the county jail where I had been for 2 years before I was convicted. And I was like, "Oh man, a cop's going to come over here, read my rights. They're going to rearrest me and retry me. And I'm going to have to go through this thing again." It's happened to so many people. They don't quit even though they know they're wrong. But then he left, the cop left, and my parents came in through a Sally Port door. And it was at that moment, I'm sitting in the back of a van, handcuffed, shackled. It's just, I'm in these orange jumpsuits, freezing. And I see my parents and I'm like, okay, they would never be in this Sally Port unless if I was going home. And that's when I knew for the very first time after the most stressful day ever that I was going home. And they opened the door and we were going to give each other hugs immediately, but I was still handcuffed in shackles. They had to unlock us. And then I hugged my mom. And yeah, it was a good feeling. And I was still, you know, very nervous and I guess you would say paranoid because I knew how they treated people. So it was a great feeling, but it was also one that I couldn't fully let loose and enjoy. And, you know, there's still a lot of concern in my mind. For months.
Well, when was the first moment, the realization that you were really set free then? Not just physically, but mentally.
I think that's a great question. I don't know that I have a specific answer for that. It happened maybe 6 months later, maybe 9 months later. It took that long to get a feeling of relief like that. And I think it was a trip that I took with my father. And we were overseas and you know, we're just having a good old time and sharing a Manhattan together, celebrating. And I didn't have to worry being in another country, you know, and I didn't have to, you know, I think at that point, the world knew I was innocent and there was so much good feedback. And I just, I don't know, it was just this odd sense that I got that I knew it was over finally, and I had nothing to worry about. And yeah, it was fleeting. Is the sad part because then it took a couple more months for me to get that feeling again. But 8 years later, I really do feel like in the last year or year and a half, that's I have it permanently. So it took that long, but I am 100% free now and really enjoying life.
So for 10 years, you lost out on a lot of opportunities, not just emotionally, you know, in your personal life, but in your college and professional life. Forgiveness, it's a tough word. What do you feel when you think about that loss of 10 years?
That's a really good question. Thank you, Kate. I feel for the other people who are still experiencing what I experienced. That's always my first thought. And that's always my last thought is just knowing that we have a criminal justice system in America. This is our criminal justice system, and it is not functioning properly. There's no accountability for police and prosecutors when they do the wrong thing. They know, you can prove they do the wrong thing, and they knew they were doing it, and there's still no accountability. You have over 2,000, 3,000 exonerations, thousands and thousands of years lost of life, and you can prove in a lot of those cases that the prosecution had evidence to prove that person's innocence. So not only did they send an innocent person to prison, they also did not get justice for the victims and their families and the communities. You know how many prosecutors lost their job over that? There's only been three.
Oh my God.
And it's just insane. And my prosecutor is now a judge. Like, you know.
Which is the worst part.
It's mind-boggling. I still don't understand it. But I do get that there's no accountability. And until there's accountability for those individuals, police and prosecutors, just the bad actors though, right? We wanna protect the people who are doing their good jobs and doing the right thing. And that's the majority. But for the bad actors, they need to be prosecuted. They need to go to prison. Because until they are, there's gonna be people like me and people like the other individuals you've interviewed who are innocent and are going to prison. And that's not going to stop. It could happen to you. It could happen to your family. It could happen to your loved ones. Mm-hmm. That's what's so scary, is that there's no end to it until we have accountability. And that's always my first thought.
What is the reality of being an inmate?
Oh, it's a tough reality. And, that's something I'm trying to bring to the world right now. As we discussed, I have a podcast of my own, Prison Counts, and we talk about that. But it's so many different things for so many different people. And the first year, the first 3 years, the first 5 years are so tough because you don't know anything and you're new and people are testing you and you're being taken advantage of and you lose all your friends and you're so alone, you're so isolated, and everything that's normal and right is taken from you and you are just crushed and the world turns gray and it's all you see is misery in there. And, that's so tough to work through. But at some point, you know, if you do enough time, as I did, you get to a point where you're just like, okay, I gotta live my life. You know, I don't know if I did 3 years, if I would have ever gotten to that point. I really don't know, because it took 4 or 5 years, maybe six. I don't really know exactly when it happened, but I started to live my life and not give the system my mind or my body. You know, I took it back and I said, I'm going to keep working on myself, growing and becoming better and taking what I can from this life. And it's because of family I was able to get there. I did a lot of work myself, obviously I had to do that, but it's terrifying, really. And people who don't have that support system that we talked about earlier that you pointed out, think that's obviously, it's impossible to get anywhere without that. And people who don't have that and still succeed and still grow and become better people, I'm amazed by them, you know, and I respect them more than anybody, because it is such a difficult reality in prison. And it's, even if you got everything, it's still almost impossible.
Did you keep in touch with anyone that you were in prison with?
I did. A couple people stuck with me the entire time. Very few, very few. And that was hard for me at first. But I came to realize that that's the way the world is. But as fortune would have it, what is this, like 18 years later, I just did the Amazing Race with one of my best friends who supported me the entire time I was in prison. And that was just the coolest thing ever, being able to call him after just all he's done for me and be like, hey, bud, you want to go do the Amazing Race? And he's like, no, what? You're kidding me, right? And I'm like, no, let's do it. And so we hung up the phone, and I can just see him in his mind. He's so charismatic, and he's just like the funniest, nicest guy. Like a minute later, he calls back. He's like, dude, are you serious? So it was really cool.
Did they contact you, or did you contact them, the Amazing Race?
No, great question. They contacted me and asked if we would like to audition. And so we did. And that's the... You know, I didn't know if we were going to get on or not, but it was cool that they reached out and gave us the opportunity. And I was like, yeah, I love the Amazing Race. I watched it in prison. Of course, I want to go do the Amazing Race. I was stuck in a cell, a little cage for 10 years. Do I want to go explore the world with my best friend? Sure. Why not?
Amazing. Whether you need to buy or sell, or you're just obsessed with looking at homes for sale, Redfin's got you covered. Redfin updates their listings every 2 minutes so you can see new homes first. And they give you personalized recommendations based on the homes that you like, so you can find the home that's just right for you, whether that's a cabin, a craftsman, or a castle. With the top-rated Redfin app, you can favorite homes, share listings with others, and schedule tours, and even on the same day, with a local Redfin agent who can help guide you through the whole home buying process. And if you're looking to sell, Redfin agents have the experience to get you the best price possible for your home. That's because they sell twice as many homes as other agents. With a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin's fees are half of what others often charge, which means you'll have more money to put towards what matters most to you, like your next home. In fact, last year, Redfin saved home sellers $127 million. No matter where you are in your real estate journey, Redfin can help. Download the Redfin app to get started today.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Well, this was interesting too, because they halted filming because of COVID. So this was unlike anything else, because it was an 18-month hiatus due to COVID-19 pandemic. So the first team to arrive in the final destination receives a $1 million prize. Competition started in London, England, shut down after the race's third leg to Scotland. So after that break, competitors started the fourth leg in Switzerland. Trips from there included traveling to France, Greece, Portugal, and Los Angeles, where the winning team crossed the finish line. How did this forever change your life, being on The Amazing Race?
I think it just added to my perspective of just, you know, I've traveled the world. I think the more we can travel, the better. But it added to my perspective in terms of what I've seen in the world and the people that I've met. But the coolest thing was seeing my buddy Dusty grow. You know, he had a rough life growing up. Nothing was easy for him. And he worked his way through school by himself, worked very hard, created an awesome life and a career. He's got a beautiful wife and a kid. And I mean, he's got the cutest family. I love him so much. And seeing him kind of grow throughout this process, because it's a struggle. It's, you know, it's very stressful racing against some amazing people every day. And, you know, you're trying to win $1 million. And so we had a lot of ups and downs. We definitely make fools of ourselves. Go Team Rusty, check us out. But it's those ups and downs that I think I learned the most about myself and friendship and growth through that experience. And I think that was really cool because, you know, we both, I guess, grew with each other in those moments. And I feel like Dusty really came out a better person from his perspective. You know, I think he's always been a great person, but he feels like he became a better person. To see that, to see somebody experience that was the coolest thing ever, especially when you have nothing but love and respect for that person. So that was really neat. And then it's just, you know, the people who were on the race with us, getting to know them, and they all had incredible experiences and done great things in the world. That always just being able to see that and be part of those lives, it just makes me want to do better things in my life and create more for the world and make it a better place in the little way that I can.
And was there anybody in the cast that you connected with more than others? Someone that really will be a part of your life forever outside of Dusty?
I would say yes, but not to just it being one or two or three people. It's really the whole cast. Like it's the strangest thing. So we have a group text, you know, everybody's talking to each other and having fun. But what's interesting is somebody mentioned on there a couple weeks ago after, you know, filming, of course, And they said, somebody was asking me like, who annoyed you the most or what team pissed you off? And they didn't have an answer. They're like, nobody. We like everybody we appreciated and respected. And I think that was, I'm like, that's exactly how I feel. And I know everybody on that cast felt the same way. Like we all just, I don't know. It's just this mutual respect and support that we all had for one another. And don't get me wrong. We were challenging each other. We were battling each other. And I was making fun of how Penn and Kim could drive, you know, and get lost or whatever. But, you know, we made fools of ourselves. I know people are like, these idiots. But aside from the fun of that, we loved each other and like respected each other. And I think that we're going to continue to speak and grow, and especially being connected on Instagram and Facebook. Yeah. We all support each other's endeavors, and it's just cool. It's cool. And I'm really, really, really happy. I think more so than pretty much anything else, just to be able to meet those people.
And were they from was anybody familiar with her case already?
A couple people were, I can't remember who now, because as you mentioned, we started filming 3 years ago. So I forget whenever people found out who I was. They're like, a couple people were like, oh my gosh, I know this case.
Yes.
Like, I'm so sorry for what happened. Yeah. And then, you know, it's funny. They always remember two things. Your father is incredible.
Yes.
And the free Ryan Ferguson car was the coolest thing I've ever seen.
I mean, I'm not kidding you. I said it to you before. I'm like, can Bill Ferguson adopt me? I did worry when I watched the documentary about your parents, the stress that the trial must have had on them individually and as a couple. Are they still married?
They are not. They actually split just prior to me being arrested. So just to make a problem worse, you know, it was very tough. Definitely so tough for them. But one thing that's always really, really, I'm glad you asked this because I don't think this is talked about enough, but this bothered me more than anything. So when I'm in prison or, you know, if a person's incarcerated, they know what they're dealing with on a daily basis. So I might wake up today and it's the worst day ever. But most days I wake up and I'm like, okay, today is going to be an okay day. I know I'm going to be fine. I know I'm not going to be hurt. I know nothing bad is going to happen to me today. And no matter how much you tell your loved ones that you're okay that day, they never really know. They never really know what you're experiencing. They never really know if you're safe. They never really know what your life is going to be in there. So they are always stressed out to the max every single day, whereas the incarcerated individual might have a couple days off mentally from that stress. And it's so sickening to know that my mother and my father, my sister, and the other people who supported me had to experience that for 10 years straight.
Yeah.
It's just, I mean, nobody should have to experience that, period. But the fact that they have to experience it for 10 years, I don't know. To this day, it makes me sick to even think about it because, no, I don't know. They're just the most amazing, beautiful people. And thinking about them feeling that way and all the other families that have to experience that, it's overwhelming.
I mean, you truly do have a fantastic family. In hindsight, there must be life lessons that you learned. Is there one thing that you know to be true?
Oh boy. This is a tough one. For me, the one thing I know to be true, and I just know this because I say it all the time, but family is everything. Mm. It's honestly, there's no even close second for me. It's just family is everything. And I can say that because mine has taught me so much and I've grown so much from them. I wouldn't be who I am without them. I would not have survived without them. But even beyond all that, just when I think about what I care about the most every morning when I wake up or before I go to bed, it's family, the people in my life. The world is made of human beings. So there's a lot of cool material possessions and stuff out there, but none of that means anything. And I've definitely had the experience to see that and know 100% that family, that's what it's about. And that's what I continue to want to grow and cherish. And I'm going to put my energy into for the rest of my life.
So here we are. You're 38 now, right?
37, I think. Yes.
Okay. You need to know how old you are.
I know. I just had a birthday. I don't even pay attention anymore. I'm like, oh, I missed 10 years. I'm a little bit older.
So are you, you're not married yet, but you've been in a relationship for 3 years. Has it held you back at all, this life experience, in terms of romantic relationships? Do you feel like it's made you a little bit untrusting? You take your time. Has it affected that part of your life at all?
When I was incarcerated, I think it definitely affected my mind a lot, on a lot of different levels. And I definitely was not trusting of human beings in general. And just relationships you see go sour and bad things happen. And so I was concerned about relationships. But fortunately, I've been so blessed to have so many incredible people in my life that it never was an issue from the moment before I got out to the moment I got out, to the relationships I've had since. I cannot say how appreciative of the people that I have had in my life. And they're just such incredible, beautiful human beings. And, you know, the people who I've had relationships with, they know who they are and they know that I support and respect them 1,000,000%. I feel like they give me that same thing. And the relationship I'm in now, I couldn't be happier. I think that contributes to what we were talking about earlier, is just that peace in life and knowing that I'm in the happiest place I've ever been is, you know, that's like, things feel right, you know, and I just feel so fortunate to feel that way. And I feel like people who've never been incarcerated don't ever get that feeling, you know, and that's kind of sad. And so, yeah, it did affect me, but I worked on it. I've read a lot. I've studied a lot. But more importantly, I've just been blessed with nothing but incredible people. And I'm so grateful to all of them.
And also there are people that you've never met who have been following your story, who think about you and wish you well. So it must be really touching when you meet people along the way who say things like, I prayed for you, or I thought about you. I'm certain that this is going to be the first of many big successes of your life because you are so intent on helping other people. And I think that this podcast that you're working on is such an important part of that. Tell everybody where they can listen to your show and where they can follow you to learn more.
Perfect. Thanks, Kate. And I just want to briefly say, you are so insightful, that you're so 100% right. People, I used to be a misanthrope to a degree because of what happened to me, because of what I saw people do to me and my family. But it is because of all the amazing people reaching out and taking time out of their day to write me letters or call or email or send letters to the governor or the prosecutor. They made me see the beauty of humanity. And that was you, and that was everybody who supported me or supports other individuals in the situation. And so, yeah, I want to talk about my podcast, but that is more important, right? The people and what we do for each other, infinitely important. So awesome insight. Thank you for bringing that up. But yeah, I'm on Instagram and Twitter as Life After 10, Ryan Ferguson. You can follow me on Facebook, Ryan Ferguson. It's just my name. There's a lot of us, so you got to kind of dig through there. But my podcast is Prison Counts. It's a podcast started not so long ago with a good friend of mine that I was actually incarcerated with, Dave Dowling, another good person who did time for a crime that he committed. He deserved to go to prison, but he's done a lot for himself. He's grown. He's turned himself into a really cool, awesome perspective or a respectable human being and does great things out in the community. So I'm happy to work with him and you know, be able to talk about what going through our criminal justice system is really like in America. And so we're going to bring new episodes every week. So please join us, check it out, share, all that fun stuff.
And what's important is that the podcast is not just interviews with those that have served time, but also people that work within the system. So prosecutors, investigators, people that have been warden. There are many facets to the story. And I think that that's what's really important about your show. And then you're on a board. Could you talk about that and tell people what they can do if they find themselves feeling as passionate as I am about wrongful imprisonment cases?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm on the board of directors, the Midwest Innocence Project, an organization that has freed quite a few people at this point. Three or four exonerations last year. It's amazing what they've done to help the community. And you can reach out and support them. You can donate money. You can donate some time, effort, and energy, you know, talking about the cases. Because the thing is, with a lot of these cases, it's about getting the word out. And if you reach out to those organizations, you can see what help is needed to get the word out, to get more, you know, there's just no funding to help innocent people. So that's a big thing. Whether you have any money you can donate yourself, you can still get out there and get the word out and start, you know, helping bring money in. That's a huge thing. But the other thing you can do is also you find a case that you believe in. And I think a lot of people did this with my case and this, I'm so grateful. But they start doing things just for that case individual because you need an army to prove your innocence. It's so sad that this is necessary because it's easy to go to prison for a crime you didn't commit. It's almost impossible to get out. So you just support them. You reach out to the family, whoever's running their pages, and you write when you can, and you start sharing their story when you can. And that really does make a huge, huge difference. So yeah, check out the Midwest Innocence Project. They're doing great work. They actually helped my case. So I mean, I will forever be grateful. And then just give back where you can. It's not quick, forward, and direct, but I can promise you that any little help makes a big difference.
So the new season of Amazing Race will air on CBS and live stream to Paramount Plus, beginning with a special 2-hour premiere this week, January 5th at 7 p.m. Again, must watch. Again, when I saw your name, I was like, oh, I mean, we have to talk. This is insane. I'm so excited for you to be on the show, but more importantly, what you're doing in your life. I'm so happy to see you so happy and healthy. Got to think of what we can get your dad on another show. I feel like
he
needs
great,
to be on he's got to be, maybe he should be like a 48 hours correspondent.
Oh, he should be 100%.
Yeah.
We got to find a position. I love where your mind's going with this. But I just want to say thank you so much for reaching out. And it's been an absolute pleasure meeting you. And I'm appreciative of all that you're doing in the world to bring these stories in front of people. And that is making a change. And so that's just super cool.
Appreciate well, you're it. Stuck with me now. Now we're friends forever.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Ryan. I want to thank my great guests, Ryan Ferguson and Steve Stoff, and remind you to click subscribe, leave a 5-star review. You must join the Facebook group Reality Life with Kate Casey. You need to join the Substack. Go to katecasey.substack.com to get my must-watch list every week in your inbox on Monday. It is worth it. I will give you a guide to what to watch all week. You can find me on Twitter at Kate Casey. I tweet about shows and during shows all week long. My Instagram is at Kate Casey, C-A. See what I'm working on all week, who I'm interviewing, and what I'm watching. And finally, you can check out my Patreon at patreon.com/KateCasey for bonus episodes. I'm telling you, it's worth it. You can hear my Josh Flagg story, my review of Paris in Love, and this crazy true crime series called Relentless on Discovery Plus, and more. And you can always check me out on Cameo also. Hope that you have a great week, and I will circle back with you on Friday.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.